Today, we're going to look at several aspects of one of the most striking physical characteristics of the Twin Cities, a natural resource which is important to the economy of this state, indeed the entire upper Midwest, one which offers tremendous recreational and aesthetic opportunities, which are so far largely untapped, but a resource which, surprisingly, is almost ignored in these cities of magnificent lakes and parks. I'm speaking, of course, of the Mississippi River. Although general public awareness of the issues affecting the river may be low, there are some very complex and even controversial activities among public agencies from the federal to the local level and among private developers, all of which will have a major impact on how the river is used in coming years. During this hour, we'll explore some of those issues.
In Life on the Mississippi, his reminiscence of his days as a river pilot, Mark Twain wrote, "I had myself called with the 4 o'clock watch mornings, for one cannot see too many summer sunrises on the Mississippi. They are enchanting. First there is the eloquence of silence, for a deep hush broods everywhere. Next there is the haunting sense of loneliness, isolation, remoteness from the worry and bustle of the world. The dawn creeps in stealthily, the solid walls of black forest soften to gray, and the vast stretches of the river open up and reveal themselves. The water is glass smooth, gives off spectral little wreaths of white mist. There is not the faintest breath of wind nor stir of leaf. The tranquility is profound and infinitely satisfying. Then a bird pipes up, another follows, and soon the pipings develop into a jubilant riot of music. You see none of the birds, you simply move through an atmosphere of song which seems to sing itself. When the light has become a little stronger, you have one of the fairest and softest pictures imaginable. You have the intense green of the massed and crowded foliage nearby. You see it paling shade by shade in front of you. Upon the next projecting cape, a mile off or more, the tint has lightened to the tender young green of spring. The cape beyond that one has almost lost color, and the furthest one, miles away under the horizon, sleeps upon the water a mere dim vapor, and hardly separable from the sky above it and about it. And all this stretch of river is a mirror, and you have the shadowy reflections of the leafage and the curving shores and the receding capes pictured in it. Well, that's all beautiful, soft and rich and beautiful, and when the sun gets well up and distributes a pink flush here and a powder of gold yonder and a purple haze where it will yield the best effect, you grant that you've seen something that is worth remembering.
If somebody wrote about the river today as Mark Twain did in the 1880s, we might think more about it. But there isn't, and many of those who help make river policies say the public practically ignores the river in the Twin Cities area. George Gribeneau chairs the Upper Mississippi River Basin Commission.
We had a boat tour recently involving 250 Minneapolis-St. Paul residents. Some of them had lived here a long time. 60% of them had never been on the Mississippi or Minnesota River before. It's one of our great untapped natural resources, and it's not really used to its fullest extent by the residents of this area.
A Citizens League committee recently did a major study of the Mississippi River in the metropolitan area. The chairman of that committee, Mary Rollwagen, believes people think of the river as a backyard. They think, incorrectly, that the river is little more than a vast open sewer. The truth is that the river is much cleaner now than it was decades ago. Some people even think it's fit for fishing and swimming in some spots. The League report of 1974 points out, too, that access to the river is limited. Vast stretches of it, especially in suburban areas, are owned privately. Public roads along the river are often so far away that people can't see the water. Rollwagen laments that even the stretches which are accessible are poorly marked.
There are parks along the Mississippi River for which there are not many signs. You don't know how to get to them. It looks like a difficult river to get to, what with the steepness of the gorge walls, and in some places, highways that go right alongside the riverbank. But there are ways to get to it, and they should be better marked.
The Citizens League also learned that river development is not a high priority for many local officials. Since the river frequently is a boundary between jurisdictions, public officials are more interested in developing recreational projects which are closer to local voters. If few Twin Cities area residents make significant use of the river, that is not true in other parts of the state. Dan McGinnis from Wabasha works with a project which is studying the river from the Twin Cities to Iowa.
The people in southeastern Minnesota are very cognizant of the river and use it heavily and recreate on it and are very aware of the fact that it's in their backyard. And I think we're very surprised that more people from the Twin City metropolitan area don't come down and use the area as well. Many people from the Twin Cities still think of the North Country, the lakes in central and northern Minnesota, as the place to go to recreate. And really, southeastern Minnesota is closer, and I don't know, we're just kind of amazed that more people haven't discovered it already.
George Gribeneau also has some thoughts on those who flee north every weekend.
They abandon the river for the lakes, and the river isn't always able to be used. There's portions of the year when it's not very good for swimming, and it's not got the fishing reputation of some of the upper lakes, and that's why we're so water rich, that we miss our biggest resource right in the heart of Minneapolis and St. Paul. When I tell you that they use the lakes of the Mississippi main stem up here, most people never think of them as being part of the Mississippi River. But from Lake Itasca down, the biggest and the most used lakes are also part of the Mississippi River. People think that they are natural lakes. They aren't. They're artificial man-made lakes, which were created at one time when it was thought that Minneapolis and St. Paul would have a water shortage, and they were constructed for municipal water purposes. Since that time, of course, we've discovered great sources of groundwater, and the aquifer system in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, Ramsey and Hennepin County, is adequate at the present time for the water needs of the population of 2 million people.
Man-made lakes, that's absolutely fascinating. I didn't know that.
Well, sure. Leech Lake, Big Sandy, Winnebogoshish, or all federal dams.
There is one project which is bringing increasing numbers of Twin Cities residents in direct touch with the river, a project begun several years ago by a man who combined his love of Minnesota history and the steamboat era into the Jonathan Paddleford, a modern-day sternwheeler run by diesel, not steam. Bill Bowl regales his passengers with anecdotes about early river developments as they ride the Paddleford from Harriet Island to Fort Snelling.
Now we're coming up here on a very interesting historical spot on a river. If you look back to your right, you'll notice a ravine. Well, many years at the head of that ravine was a cave. And that cave had a stream of water coming out of it. Well, in the 1830s, there was an ugly, bearded, scarred, one-eyed character with the one eye that would sort of look like a pig's eye. Old Pig's Eye made his living selling liquor to the soldiers at Fort Snelling about 4 miles upstream. He was a bootlegger. Well, about 1838, the Commandant at Fort Snelling decided that they would no longer allow squatters on the property around the fort. And they requested that 150 families move, and they refused to. The Commandant was forced to send his soldiers in, and they made the people move out onto the sod, and then they burnt their homes. Well, they had no place to go, and they sort of gravitated downstream here to the area of Old Pig's Eye's cave. And here they formed the little community called Pig's Eye. Well, about 3 years later, in 1841, a young Catholic priest came by the name of Father Lucien Galtier, and he established a little log chapel downstream about a mile. And the people from the community of Pig's Eye would go down to his church on Sunday. Well, it wasn't long before they decided perhaps it would be proper if they would change the name of their little community from Pig's Eye to the name of that log chapel. And of course, it was a chapel of St. Paul. And back there by the orange post is where St. Paul began.
Where'd you learn all this about the river?
I guess it goes back to my days as a curator with the Minnesota Historical Society, and where I developed an interest in Minnesota history. And I might say it probably laid dormant for a few years, but since I began this operation, I have developed quite a library on the Mississippi River and a very extensive library on Minnesota history.
How long have you had this passenger boat operation?
Well, this is our seventh year on the river here. I built the Paddleford in 1969, and we put it in service, I believe it was May 16th. Yeah, we have the other boat now also, the Josiah Snelling.
How many people ride this each year?
Last year we had over 100,000 people. And it's been going up each year.
The fog is rolling down the river. Dark clouds hanging mighty low. Well, it's a long, long way from old St. Louis to the Gulf of Mexico. Well, I make my home on the Mississippi. I'm a roustabout on a steamboat line. We hit the deck on a Monday morning, but we make the dots on a Saturday night. Well, I had me a girl way down in Vicksburg. I used to stop every time I passed till she made off with a riverboat gown, with a new silk suit and a little mustache. Well, I make my home on the Mississippi. I'm a roustabout on a steamboat line. We hit the deck on a Monday morning, but we make the dots on a Saturday night. Now when I die, I've got one favor. Don't lay me down in the cocoa ground. Just take me out to the middle of the river and roll me over and point me south. Well, I make my home on the Mississippi. I'm a roustabout on a steamboat line. We hit the deck on a Monday morning, but we'll make the dock on a Saturday night.
Now, the great heyday of steamboating on this river was from 1840 to 1880. You might be interested to know that during that period of time, the average life of a steamboat was only 3 years. The most important reason for the sudden demise of a steamboat was the fact that the boilers were frequently blowing. Now, steamboating was very, very competitive, and the captains were always racing one another to the next port. They knew the first one there would probably get the preferred cargoes. It wasn't unusual for a captain to look out of the corner of his eye and see another boat coming up. He'd grab hold of the speaking tube and holler down to the boys in the engine room, "Fire her up, we got a race coming on." And after a while, if he didn't get enough steam, he might call the cabin boy up and tell him, "Son, now you go down to the ship stores and get a keg of lard and go down there to the engine room and tell the boys to put it on the fire." Many times, the chief engineer down below would become very aggravated at the old goat up there in the pilot house calling for more and more steam. Finally, they'd take a heavy object, such as a keg of nails, put it on the steam safety valve. And of course, this little trick won many a race, but many a time it blew the boat, the captain, and the crew to kingdom come.
In the flush times of steamboating, a race between two notoriously fleet steamers was an event of vast importance. The date was set for it several weeks in advance, and from that time forward, the whole Mississippi Valley was in a state of consuming excitement. Politics and the weather were dropped, and people talked only of the coming race. As the time approached, the two steamers stripped and got ready. Every encumbrance that added weight or exposed a resisting surface to wind or water was removed, if the boat could possibly do without it. The spars, and sometimes even their supporting derricks, were sent ashore, and no means left to set the boat afloat in case she got aground. When the Eclipse and the A.L. Shotwell ran their great race many years ago, it was said that pains were taken to scrape the gilding off the fanciful device which hung between the Eclipse's chimneys, and that for that one trip, the captain left off his kid gloves and had his head shaved, but I always doubted these things. If the boat was known to make her best speed when drawing 5.5 feet of water forward and 5 feet aft, she carefully loaded to that exact figure, and she wouldn't enter a dose of homeopathic pills on her manifest after that. Hardly any passengers were taken, because they not only add weight, but they never will trim the boat. They always run to the side when there's anything to see, whereas a conscientious and experienced steamboat man would stick to the center of the boat and part his hair in the middle with a spirit level. No way freights and no way passengers were allowed, for the racers would stop only at the largest towns, and then it would be only touch and go. Coal flats and wood flats were contracted for beforehand, and these were kept ready to hitch on to the flying steamers at a moment's warning. Double crews were carried so that all work could be quickly done. The chosen date being come and all things in readiness, the two great steamers back into the stream and lie there jockeying a moment, apparently watching each other's slightest movement like sentient creatures, flags drooping, the pent steam shrieking through safety valves, the black smoke rolling and tumbling from the chimneys and darkening all the air. People everywhere, the shores, the housetops, the steamboats, the ships are packed with them. And you know that the borders of the broad Mississippi are going to be fringed with humanity thence northward 1,200 miles to welcome these racers.
Of course, it was because of the river that this area was settled in the first place. The river was responsible for the Twin Cities becoming a major business center for the entire upper Midwest. Throughout the late 1800s, the river was a major highway for both passengers and freight. Competition from the railroads by the turn of the century cut river traffic drastically. But when Congress authorized construction of a 9-foot channel and a series of locks and dams on the river in the 1930s, barge transportation increased, and now millions of tons of cargoes are carried on the river every year. Industrial development on the river banks began soon after the Twin Cities was first settled. Lumbering and flour milling were common at St. Anthony Falls. Steamboating and related industries developed as St. Paul became a major port. Later, the riverfront became an attractive site for railroads, since it was easier to lay tracks along the flat land next to the river than it was further inland. So industries which relied on rail transportation developed along the riverfront. Still other industries later found the river a convenient dumping ground for wastes. Jock Robertson, an official at the Minnesota Department of Planning, observes that through the years, the Mississippi River has retained its unique characteristics.
This stretch of the river corridor is unique geologically. It contains a part of the glacial river Warren, the gorge below Fort Snelling, where it intersects the Minnesota, has a lot of remnants of that geology, plus the newer geology of St. Anthony Falls and Minnehaha Falls. It has many historical artifacts from the earliest inhabitants of the continent. It has, of course, scenic beauty. On the other hand, it is very, very valuable because it is in such close proximity to the 2 million people who live in the metropolitan area who have access to both the recreational and historical and scientific interest of the gorge. And finally, because it is in the metropolitan area, it is under constant pressure to be used in a number of ways, some of which are compatible and some of which may be competing or destructive. For instance, it's very necessary to use the river for hauling of freight. That's part of the economic lifeline of this area and of the state and of the upper Midwest. It is also a source of supply for water for a majority of residents of the area. It's also receiving water to assimilate treated sewage. And that's very important. That has to be balanced. And so you have the necessary trade-offs required between the transportation and recreation use of the river itself. And it's very unique to find all those things in a 50, 60, 70-mile stretch of the river.
The Citizens League warned 2 years ago that there will be increasing pressures as well as opportunities on the riverfront. The use of riverfront land will probably change in the future, with pressure to develop or redevelop significant portions. Increased grain shipments from the Midwest and our need for low-sulfur coal, for example, will likely lead to increased barge traffic. Mary Rollwagen of the Citizens League.
We spent a lot of time in the committee, as a matter of fact, discussing commercial navigation and its effects on the river. It certainly seems that transporting bulk commodities by barge is cheaper in terms of money and in terms of energy than to do so by train or highway or whatever. So that the number of barges on the river certainly isn't going to decrease and may well increase. At the same time, the number of small boats on the river is increasing too. So far, I don't think there's been enough of each to provide for super traffic jams, but that may well come.
Increased barge traffic also implies additional river dredging by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The material scooped from the river bottom is called spoils. Over 300,000 cubic yards of this material is dredged each year north of Hastings. The dredged spoils are deposited along riverfront land largely. This causes environmental problems in a few spots. It tends to narrow the river channel. At points, it conflicts aesthetically with the rugged beauty of the riverfront, and it can close off backwaters, destroying fish and wildlife. However, the spoils have also created sandbars in the river, which are used by boaters for picnic spots and beaches. The Citizens League also predicts that additional riverfront land will be needed for commercial and industrial development. The riverfront will become increasingly attractive as well for housing developments, and that concerns Committee Chairman Mary Rollwagen.
There was a possibility for some time, quite a real possibility, that a large apartment building of some 27 stories would be constructed in the floodplain, that is, right down next to the river, across from Fort Snelling, across the Mississippi from Fort Snelling. That's a very wild area, almost all of it, owned by some governmental unit or other. In an apartment building that was rising right out of the river valley and up above the bluff line, I think would have been a very inappropriate thing in that spot. As it happens, the building, I gather, is not going to be built. For a while, it was simply a matter of financing that couldn't be gotten, and now I think the city of St. Paul has some plans to acquire that land.
Where do you think an apartment building like the one you described would be appropriate? Or if nowhere, what kind of housing development right along the river would be acceptable?
I personally don't feel they're appropriate along a riverbank, but I'm not speaking for the committee in that respect. Some of the members couldn't resolve that one, finally. Some of the members felt that they were appropriate as long as they were set back far enough so as not to obstruct other people's view, and that they weren't bunched together, one after another, up and down the river. San Francisco has a requirement that sets up sight lines from the shore of the bay, and the further back from the bay you get, the higher you can build. The closer to the bay, the lower your building has to be. I think that's a very good idea.
Another project which has caused controversy is Northern States Power Company's plan for a coal terminal at Pig's Eye Lake. The original plan was rejected by the St. Paul City Council. The company is now preparing a new plan, which should be ready in a couple of weeks. Rollwagen and other members of the Citizens League River Committee readily agree that some development of the riverfront in the Twin Cities area is inevitable, even desirable, so long as one use does not preclude others. The League concludes that within limits, transportation, housing, and recreation are legitimate river activities. One developer who is making appropriate use of the river, apparently, is Minneapolis businessman Louis Zelli.
For many years, we've been involved or owned some land along Main Street in the area where the Prochnow restaurant is. And well, it's that block and the next one. And we're just finishing up the final plans and contracts for the development of the first building, which we call Salisbury A. There's used to be part of the old Salisbury mattress operation, which is a very nice building built about 1900, and you know, with big timbers and very good brick and that kind of thing. And then the other buildings across the way are some of the oldest in the city. I mean, the oldest substantial ones. One was the first post office and fire station, and one was, or what we call the Upton Building, was built about 1850, I believe, which, you know, is very early for a brick-type substantial building.
What will be in those buildings after you have...
Restaurants, attractive shops. This is, in a sense, it's a little of the order of things like Trolley Square in Salt Lake and Ghirardelli Square in San Francisco, and the kind of thing that seems to be coming back in this country, which is usually around refurbished old buildings. We would then go on and have some residential area.
Would these be townhouse-type things or single-family?
Yeah. And some of it would be using the loft space in some of the buildings there, which are, you know, really very attractive, 14-foot ceilings and that kind of thing.
When do you think all this will be done?
Well, I'd hope we'd begin the first part either the end of this month or in September, and we'll just go right on from there.
Zelli's enthusiasm extends to the city's plans to make the river more accessible to the public in the St. Anthony Falls area.
The river itself is absolutely marvelous, you know, and this is one of the few places that, you know, in order to see the falls really well, you have to crawl over a fence, which has got spikes on the top, and climb down and then walk out on a kind of a pier. It's a sensational thing, and this is the kind of thing that ought to be public, and I think in the next few years will be. The city has been remarkable about it. I mean, the city plans are, I think, as fine as anything I've ever seen. The fact is that they really are doing it, and the designs are just first class. I would think that we'll end up if these things go along in the next few years, we'll probably have, I think, really the finest center of the river of any and most interesting place in the country.
So many river projects are possible that it's obvious some coordinated planning is necessary. The Citizens League recommends that development on the riverfront should be based on standards to protect the river bluffs, to ensure that roadways along the river enhance it, that existing parks are protected, that the density of development is controlled. And the League concludes that the existing government process is not adequate to manage the riverfront. So the League recommended 2 years ago that the river be designated a critical area by Governor Anderson. The Critical Areas Act was passed by the legislature in 1973. It gives the governor authority to declare the designation on recommendation from a local or regional planning group or the Environmental Quality Council, the EQC. Jock Robertson from the State Planning Agency explains what the governor's action does.
His designation order sets up a partnership, essentially between the EQC and any local government or state agency that has jurisdiction in the designated critical area. Under that partnership, under the provisions of the Act, those agencies must amend plans and regulations where they have them, or prepare new plans and regulations, if none exist, to be consistent with the guidelines that are contained in the governor's designation order. They have half a year to make those amendments or those preparations and bring them to the EQC for approval. Once those plans and regulations are approved by EQC, the local governments and state agencies then implement the plans and regulations under the authority that they normally have to implement plans and regulations, but that then they are consistent then with each other, that the purpose is to try to eliminate conflicts or overlaps between jurisdictions and make sure that those agencies' programs, management programs, are consistent with state interests. The governor, his designation order is only temporary until finally confirmed by the legislature. And this confirmation by the legislature or by legislative action must be made within 3 years after the designation order. Otherwise, the designation order lapses. The law says that this confirmation can also be made by a regional development commission.
Why are there so many steps in this process? Why are so many agencies involved? Why does it go back to the legislature for approval or the planning commission?
Probably one reason is that the spirit of the Act is very clearly intended to set up a partnership. It does not envision a dictatorial or top-down planning process, if you will, from the state agencies to local government and private landowners. It seems perhaps an unnecessary detail, but very important to make sure that it's spelled out clearly, that agencies have limited time to react. They can't table things and stall things by not acting on them. And if you read the statute and the rules, you find that sort of a thread of continuity.
There are, of course, many government agencies involved in the critical area from Anoka to Hastings. It seems to me like there is a distinct potential for conflict between those government agencies, rivalry among them, disagreement among them.
Certainly there is a certain amount of rivalry, disagreement, contention between local governments, between themselves and state agencies. On the other hand, sometimes it is very useful for them when dealing with private development. Many times a private developer will simply say to a local unit of government, well, if you don't adjust your zoning to fit my proposed development, I will go upstream or downstream to another community and they'll let me do it, and you will be the losers because you won't have this development in your community. So to a certain extent, you know, that prevents that because it gives everybody a uniform set of of rules to operate under, and it prevents communities and state agencies from being played off against each other.
The critical area designation includes that part of the river from Anoka to Hastings. The Mississippi north of Anoka to St. Cloud is also protected by another device, the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. Mike Presnitz, Rivers Coordinator at the Department of Natural Resources, explained that program as we wrote on the Jonathan Paddleford.
Generally, the critical areas program is designed to provide interim protection until long-range plans can be prepared on critical areas, those that need immediate attention and are of more than just local significance. The Wild and Scenic Rivers program, by its very name, is meant or was intended to really be applied to rivers that are in an essentially natural condition. In the case of the Wild and Scenic Rivers designation, St. Cloud and Anoka, there really aren't any significant restrictions on recreational use that aren't there right now. Can use it pretty much as they have in the past. And in the metro area, that's pretty much the case as well under the critical areas program.
What kind of development are you trying to restrict along the northern section?
We're trying to control or hold the line on urban sprawl, for one. Secondly, to prohibit, at least in the undeveloped or rural areas, any large commercial expansion or industrial expansion immediately along the river.
Because of all the things the river is used for, there is a good deal of argument among the different interests. Again, Mike Presnitz.
Oh, I think there's a diversity of opinions as to what should be done with the river and also who should be doing it. Our particular proposal, St. Cloud to Anoka, was quite a controversial one. We had, in essence, from a citizen standpoint, almost a classic confrontation of interests on the river between farmers on the upper end who were being squeezed out by urban sprawl and the development interests on the lower end, particularly Elk River to Anoka, that saw an opportunity to make a lot of money by land speculation. The developers have already said that they are intending to test certain of the provisions, zoning controls, in court.
Mike Presnitz of the Department of Natural Resources. Some people, like Jack Lambert, president of the Twin City Barge and Towing Company, see the attempts to limit development through the Critical Areas Act as a restriction on commerce, which may have serious impact not only on businesses which use the river, but on the economy of the entire Upper Midwest.
The essential aspect of the Critical Areas Act was to freeze a great deal of acreage, thousands of acres, as open space. Now, God knows we need some open space, we need parks, and we need all that sort of thing. We also need jobs, we need commerce, we need industry. Open space doesn't pay any taxes, it doesn't provide any jobs. It's needed by everyone, but there's got to be some reasonable limit to it. The regulations already on the books prior to the critical areas coming to pass have made it almost impossible for any industrial development. It's even making it difficult for commerce to continue to flow on the inland rivers. Now you superimpose on top of the federal and state regulations already on the books this Critical Areas Act, and it's just one more layer of bureaucratic red tape, the intention of which is to bog down and restrict the development of the river valley.
And indeed, the critical area designation does place some very specific limits on various activities. New barge slips are not allowed in urban open space areas. New roads must intrude as little as possible into the scenery, yet they must provide views for motorists. New buildings have to be set back a specific distance from the river or from the bluffs. They generally cannot exceed 35 feet in height, and there are additional regulations covering waste treatment facilities, commercial and industrial developments, agriculture, and recreation. There is at least one other major policymaking body and planning body which affects the river. That is the Upper Mississippi River Basin Commission. Created by the president, the commission includes the directors of 10 federal agencies and representatives from 6 states, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, and Missouri. The chairman of the Upper Mississippi River Basin Commission is George Gribeneau.
Basically, the River Basin Commission develops plans, programs, and policies that not only impact on navigation, but on power plant siting, transportation surveys, bridge construction, and all of the things that have anything to do with the Mississippi River. Well, it's getting quite obvious that if any state embarks on a project or a program by itself, it's in danger of litigation, it's in danger of being at sword's point with a bordering state, with a federal energy program, with the rules and regulations of the Environmental Protection Agency, or with some other unknown factor. So the best thing to do is to get the agencies together right at the beginning of any program or any change in policy and ask them for input right at the beginning.
Is the commission at all involved in the critical area designation?
The governor has that completely at his prerogative. What happens is that the work of the commission makes it easier for the governor to make a decision that's in the total public interest. By the time the governor has that on his desk, commission has massaged it, processed it, reviewed it. All of the agencies have commented on it. The governor has a much easier choice, or at least he knows what the alternatives are and which way to go. Personally, I favor the critical area designation for the metropolitan area that's before Governor Anderson at the present time.
One of the commission's most visible projects is a major study of the river from the Twin Cities to Gutenberg, Iowa. The study is called GREAT. That's an acronym for Great River Environmental Action Team. Its members include representatives from many state, federal, and local river interests. Wabasha resident Dan McGinnis, public participation coordinator for GREAT, talked about the study and about the possibility of critical area designation for sections of the river south from Hastings.
I don't know of anyone that's taken it seriously upon themselves to promote any sort of critical areas designation for the balance of the river. And I don't think our Regional Development Commission has considered it. And I know of no local unit of government that's considered it.
Do you think it's necessary there or not?
It might depend heavily on how well the Great River Study, which is a kind of a joint state-federal study of the Mississippi River from the Twin Cities on down to Gutenberg, Iowa, how well that study pans out. That study has an ultimate goal of trying to develop a river management plan that takes in all the various interests. And I think if that study works out, critical areas designation wouldn't be necessary.
When is that study scheduled for completion?
We're looking at a 1978 or 1979 completion date on that study. We're just in the very beginning phases of it now, of defining the problems. One of the problems or conflicts on the river that really got the ball rolling as far as creating the GREAT study and the GREAT team was the conflict of dredging by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to maintain the navigation channel, and the fact that some 194,000 acres of land from Wabasha down to Rock Island is a national wildlife refuge. And the dredging activity, in many cases, was destroying or helping to destroy some valuable wildlife habitat. If the dredge material itself is placed properly, creates a minimum negative impact. But when it's dumped into some of the shallow marsh areas, it's stealing away some of the prime waterfowl breeding and nesting habitat and some very good fish habitat.
Okay, now in the course of dealing with that one major problem of dredge spoils, you're likely to come up with some other problems.
What is the river's capacity as far as how much barge traffic can it handle when you add to that recreational traffic on the river? And of course, one of the things that is going to be have to dealt with, and probably will have to be dealt with more at the local level than any place else, is development along the river sides. Anyone who's taken a drive down the what we call the South Shore, the Mississippi River Valley, will see a lot of beautiful yet natural bluff lines along the river that so far have been able to miss any sort of major development. And I think one of the things that's the thing that is yet to come is a real pressure for development of those bluff areas for second homes, for recreational uses. And one of the major conflicts that I see that we're going to have to be facing in the future is some way to save that natural beauty, which is what has attracted so many people in the first place.
Well, there's so many governmental jurisdictions that deal with the river, some federal jurisdictions with the Corps of Engineers, there's certainly the state, local governments, regional planning agencies and so forth. Isn't there almost an over-proliferation of government action on the river?
You're quite right, that's a real problem. For private developers, it becomes a regular nightmare to attempt to receive all the necessary approvals that must be received to do a development on the river. And a private developer might spend literally years trying to get approval to simply dredge out a section of the river. That's one of the real problems that we face, is trying to wade through the red tape.
Is that one of the things that the great team will address?
I don't know if coming together with a management plan that takes into consideration all those interests will minimize the red tape at all, but I hope so.
Although a large number of agencies have jurisdictions over the river, there does seem to be some general agreement on the need for careful planning to permit maximum use of the river and to minimize conflicting demands on the resource. The chairman of the Citizens League River Study, Mary Rollwagen, had a final suggestion which might make it easier for area residents to follow river developments. She proposed a single place where river plans are collected.
The critical area is, in a sense, a defense mechanism. It prevents things, but it doesn't necessarily start anything. And I think there are all kinds of things that can be done along the edge of the river on both sides that will encourage people to go and use the river. And there isn't any one place where ideas for that can be looked into and developed a little bit, where maybe even some people could start going out and hustling some funds for doing the kinds of things that might be necessary. Just places where you can park your car and get out and walk. Signs for hiking trails and biking trails. Canoe access points. And it would be nice if there were one spot within the metropolitan area, one body, where these things could begin to gel and start to be done.
She'd also like to see a citizens committee active on the river's behalf, much as neighborhood associations are in various parts of the Twin Cities. During this broadcast, we've tried to outline some of the pressures on the river, pressures which, if left by themselves, might destroy a great public resource before most people even know it exists. The Citizens League has urged that the river be declared a critical area by the governor. All development plans will have to be approved by the Environmental Quality Council, and the entire critical area designation with accompanying plans will have to be approved by the state legislature or by the Metropolitan Council within 3 years. During this broadcast, we've heard selections from Life on the Mississippi by Mark Twain, read by Garrison Keeler, and music by Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs. Technical director has been Lynn Cruz. This is Bob Potter speaking.
Now this is a story about a young man from Natchez, Mississippi, whose father took a steamboat called the Delta Queen to New Orleans and got killed in a poker game. The young man thought about it for a while and then decided on revenge. And he said, "I'm going to ride that steamboat." A steamboat took my daddy to New Orleans. He got killed in a poker game downtown. Steamboat took my daddy to New Orleans. Some crooked Cajun gambler shot him down. Daddy rode that steamboat, didn't take me along. And I've been sitting here thinking all day long. And I'm gonna ride that steamboat, take my gun along. I'll get that man who done my daddy wrong. Steamboat took my daddy to New Orleans. Daddy was pretty good with a deck of cards. He said that he'd get rich in New Orleans, 'cause the games are good and the cash is cold and hard. But you can't win no money when the deck of cards are stacked and the steamboat never broke my daddy back. And I'm a-gonna ride that steamboat, take my gun along, I'll get that man who done my daddy wrong. Steamboat took my daddy to New Orleans. I know he wanted that money for us kids. Steamboat took my daddy to New Orleans. Now mama won't forgive the things he did. Daddy rode that steamboat, never took mama along, and she's been sitting here crying all day long. And I'm a-gonna ride that steamboat, take my gun along, I'll get that man who done my daddy wrong. I'll get that man who done my daddy wrong.